Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I am sure that most of you probably know Monday, April 12th, was Astoria's 199th birthday, 1 year short of its bicentennial as the oldest American city west of the Mississippi River. And I remember when I worked up at the Astoria Column, a number of people would say very knowingly, especially to their children, that John Jacob Astor founded Astoria and died on the Titanic. Of course, that was 101 years and 4 days in between. It was actually his great-grandson, I believe it was, John Jacob Astor V, who perished on the Titanic. And today is, of course, tax day. And I have something I've written and rewritten, which I'd like to read today in commemoration. I call it The Tax Wars, and I started with a quote by Exene Cervenka, lead singer of the punk band X. I've killed more people than Unabomber Ted Kaczynski because I've been paying a lot of taxes the past 15 years, and he hasn't. And I must give the disclaimer that what you're about to hear is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the cosmos. The tax wars. American history boiled to the bone might be encapsulated as war and the money, rather than about rights, liberties, and equality. And the reduction might be further compressed if it is argued that the wars we have all been fought for money, which would reconfigure the pursuit of wealth as the total fabric of the USA's manifest destiny. This perspective of history is obviously an injustice to those who have struggled and often been jailed, bled, or died for the larger beliefs relevant in the Bill of Rights. Yet the very fact of the intensity of the strife for equity and justice within our own Constitution gives legitimacy to the claim that for the powerful elite, money is the only mainspring of the nation's history. If indeed this narrow view of history has any credence, it must be realized that a select few have, from the very beginning, profited from the collective effort of the many. In this context, the term freedom is misapplied, both politically and economically. Free enterprise is a misnomer for the fact that throughout the country's 234-year history, from 1776, the wealthiest Americans have for the most part accumulated and maintained their wealth at government expense, essentially through sales and subsidies, you might say, and most recently, gigantic bailouts of the financial sector that has highly bankrupted the nation, as well as much of the world, which can also be defined as the blood and taxes of the majority, who generally make possible but seldom share in the overall abundance. Newt Gingrich used to say, "The engine that pulls the train must be refueled." By that he meant the new Tories of wealth and business should not share tax obligations with the common folk. Affluent taxpayers must receive breaks because they invest money and create jobs for others, Newt explained disingenuously, as if it hadn't been said before. In reality, those affluent taxpayers rarely invest in anything except their own stock portfolios, and they not only do not pay their fair share of taxes, they gorge on public money, which people like Gingrich and former President G.W. Bush call welfare when it is distributed among the poor, and investment when extorted by the rich. At the same time our political lords cut off welfare to single mothers and downsize workers, they initiate special tax breaks to favored corporations that amount to billions of dollars. They cut the taxes of big business, which invests a portion into the welfare of favored politicians, and the rich, who are shareholders in most of these same corporations, and spoil them with billions more in subsidies they claim are essentials to the free market, which is regarded as a natural force. Public services and poverty programs are gutted to make up for the shortfall. The rich get richer, and the poor get poorer, because the poor subsidize the rich. That is national tax policy. Corporations are, after all, inherently socialist rather than capitalist. Big business does not compete for sheer love of competition in an unfettered emporium of commerce, which is the myth of capitalism. The almighty free market is, in truth, the savage battleground to dominate the American economy in the bitter, ruthless goal of winner-take-all. The neo-Tories quote Jefferson, twist him into a laissez-faire philosopher. Gingrich again. When Jefferson said every generation needs a revolution, he wasn't making an argument for chaos. He was making an argument for the creative replacement of the old order with a new order, quote unquote. But old Tom's intent was to replace a repressive and corrupt colonial government with a truly revolutionary guarantee of power to the people. The new Tories' purpose is to return the USA to the vertically organized and patronage-dominated 18th century that the American and French revolutions blew asunder. Attempting to reestablish an old order of privilege and power based on wealth and property in this new millennium runs counter to Thomas Paine's vision of a decent and happy life for ordinary Americans who are assumed to be rulers rather than ruled. The plutocrats who control the major corporations claim the economy defines the nation more than its ideology. Money, they say, is the nation's ideology. What they mean by their strict definition of the economy is their own personal domination of the national wealth. In theory, everybody has an equal chance to make a buck and live the American dream. But of course, some are more equal than others. Narrow monetary policies that singularly benefit the upper layers of society draw money from less well-off levels, which keeps them less well-off and always under pressure to pay what is demanded. Releasing public money, most of it pried from middle class and blue-collar labor, to business and the wealthy elite is considered sound investment and essential to the economy. Providing public funds to the poor is regarded as uneconomical and a severe drain on the national treasury. Corporate culture is conditioned by commercial and public falsehoods that coerce the people to buy and pledge allegiance to America Incorporated, which transforms the American public from a democratic citizenry responsible for its rights, liberties, and pursuit of justice and equality, to pre-adolescently avaricious consumers for whom only money and material possessions count. Ralph Nader says that a civic culture has been swarmed over by a corporate culture. The pattern of corporate dominance is as true for the USA today as it was for the Nazis and fascists early in the 20th century. Wage slashes and huge government subsidies and tax cuts for the already affluent. The Nazis and fascists maintained their grip on power by enriching their industrial patrons while tyrannizing the populaces of their nations. Corporations receive rebates on taxes they never paid and resent government intrusion, and that's in quotes, into their affairs, criticizing regulations regarding their methods of business. However, they do not think government tax breaks or subsidies should be curtailed, and certainly not huge bailouts of tax money when their financial policies drive them and most of the rest of the country into insolvency. The rupture between corporate profit and national economic growth is seen in the dependence of the private sector's profits in looting the public treasury, pillaging the natural environment, and reducing social services instead of developing new technology and enlarging markets through expansion of goods and services. Billions of dollars are appropriated from important areas like healthcare and housing. The private plunder of the public domain extends to natural resources. Land, seabeds, and timber are stripped or despoiled without regard for long-term consequences. Laying off millions of workers from employment as well as shipping jobs overseas, necessitates huge welfare costs, which the wealthy who eliminate the jobs are not paying, leaving it up to already overburdened middle and working class taxpayers to pay. The U.S. gloats in its reigning superpower status and acts in the old Roman way, inflicting its immense capacity for war upon the world, which is its main offering to the New World Order. But it is a defective colossus. Its economy has come undone, the imperial fabric tearing apart due to its own internal rapacity and the hundreds of trillions of dollars of public money wasted on the military at the expense of its own internal civic disintegration in the holy names of defense, national security, and now this new war on terrorism, which must be paid for. Taxes will be raised from the humble and underfed. More money will be looted from already prostrate social programs, and heavy borrowing from other more cash-fattened nations will probably be essential to prop up and replenish our hugely expensive military machine. The domestic decline of the United States is primarily the responsibility of the armed might that has bestowed its celebrated victories, the military-industrial complex that one of its most fortunate and celebrated benefactors, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was not at all a private, he was a general, warned the nation about when he left office 4 decades ago. This giant interlocking mafia of corporations and the military machine they built, as well as congressional acquiescence, which is the third leg of the triad, fashioned an American overseas empire. The nation was itself created and forged by war and an insatiable appetite for military power. War is the ultimate form of economic competition, Brooks Adams wrote at the beginning of America's reach for global supremacy. And I made an error. Dwight Eisenhower left office 5 decades ago, 1961. Even if we eventually surface from the economic disaster brought on by Wall Street and its casino banks, the Pentagon's bloated budget has soared to a huge black hole into which everything is eventually drawn and disappears, such as the nation's wealth and resources, with neither replaced. Now, a decade into the 21st century, amidst the flaring testosterone of two wars and claims they justify the largest Pentagon budget in 2 decades, which does not include billions of dollars sent to Iraq, the infrastructure of American society has declined further, and ever larger numbers of the nation's useful citizens sink into poverty. The malign neglect of the huge and growing underclass that lives abandoned and without hope in the nation's crumbling inner cities and impoverished rural areas will eventually ravage the society more than foreign terrorists can ever hope to achieve, and will certainly give rise to domestic terrorism if only for the purposes of survival. Millions of children live in poverty in the United States, most of them not white, which significantly lessens their chances of escaping destitution due to this country's prevailing racism. Dr. Charles Wilder, former director of Clatsop County Community Action Agency, once said that the war on poverty has become the war on the poor. The upward flow of the nation's wealth must be reversed, and the arid trickle-down become a flood if this trend is to be overhauled. The growing disparities in wealth and living standards undermine our society and threaten civil disorder on a massive scale, which presupposes a grim specter of the future worse than terrorism. Remedies for repairing our ravaged economy and reversing the intolerable social catastrophe it has precipitated are many, varied, complex, and depend on reapplying the nation's fundamental principles with fresh interpretations. The reestablishment of a union culture and radical reform of labor laws should be a primary goal, for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic and political recovery. But across-the-board tax reform that drastically reduces the military budget and eliminates the two-tiered tax system in which the privileged get most of the breaks and the rest of the citizenry pay the bulk of taxes should be a serious consideration of returning power to the people. The tax system must be reformed in favor of taxpayers, first guaranteeing each an accounting of their money used by every level of government, and that basic returns for that money be automatic priorities such as food, shelter, and health and medical care. After that, the basic infrastructures of a society that are the basis for taxation, such as transportation and energy requirements, public safety, emergency relief, and general livability for average citizens, must be maintained. The present system of required payment of taxes without any accountability for their use by government must be reversed, which is possible with computerization of all public agencies. It will eventually be feasible in such a system that taxpayers have the legal power to determine where and how their tax monies are spent. Tax reformers usually attempt to allocate more tax monies to environmental and poverty programs, and many ideas are creative, such as energy and environmental taxes, as well as use and consumption taxes. Progressive taxation is the fairest redistribution of taxes from the wealthy to those most in need. But ultimately, only a strong and determined tax revolt by a large number of ordinary citizens will bring about adequate and necessary reform. The debate over income taxes is long-standing and bitter. Groups both politically right and left wish to abolish the current tax system, which they claim is unconstitutional despite the superseding of original intent by the 16th Amendment. With the exception of the Civil War, Americans did not pay income taxes until 1913, and withholding taxes deducted from wages was a World War II innovation. The question of whether taxes should be collected under any circumstances might be answered that they be apportioned, raised, or lowered in consideration of the real needs of society rather than the corporate welfare the tax system has become. The real power for change is revolt, which, if conducted by millions, could probably even subvert the extortion as well as tyranny of withholding paychecks before workers ever see them. It is quite probable the government would consider mass rebellion by taxpayers the worst conceivable form of terrorism and savagely respond with a campaign of extra-legal, police state-style counter-terror, which is why any such revolt would have to occur in stages and obviously involve the courts, as well as simply refusing to file the forms, and must appeal to the most fundamental doctrines of the nation. Paradoxically, the theory of progressive taxation might as well be Marxist. Each pays according to his or her ability, according to their needs and obligations. The theory is that what is taken out of society should also be proportionately put back. The more you get, the more you are obliged to return. The reality is that those who reap the most give back the least, if they give back at all. And that which they keep is unproportionately made up by taxing those who reap the least. The greatest tax upon the society is the enormous cash flow of public money that disappears into the private fortunes of those who arrogantly loot the national treasury in full knowledge their avarice is unquestionably sanctioned. Perhaps as good an example of the inequity of the current tax system is that public money has been appropriated without public consent to bail out financial firms whose criminal greed has created the economic collapse that has thrown millions of ordinary Americans out of work and caused the foreclosure of millions of homes. The immediate response by the government during this, the worst financial disaster since the Great Depression, was to provide hundreds of billions of public taxes to prop up the guilty institutions while belatedly, one might even say reluctantly, providing considerably less economic aid to the rest of the country that has suffered the most and whose taxes have protected the affluence of those whose reckless greed triggered the disaster. Theodore Roosevelt had it right when he said, "The real enemy of anarchist capitalists are socialist working people." And that was something I wrote, The Tax Wars. And now I'd like to conclude the program with something else I wrote, Reefer Madness. And it is about marijuana, which has once again become a driving force towards legality in this country, including Oregon and Washington, primarily for medical purposes, but also for others. It's simply that the laws against marijuana are like cutting off our noses to spite our faces. And so I must say that what I'm about to read is the disclaimer that I said earlier still holds. My drugs of choice are red wine and marijuana. One is legal, the other is not, and I have not heard a rational reason why. There is no logic that one should be benignly supported while the other makes criminals of its users and producers. My Sicilian grandfather made wine for the church, and that's in quotes, during Prohibition, and kept a few bottles for himself, which could have got him arrested. But marijuana was legal then. 80 years later, I can legally drink the wine, but if I intake some bud, I am subject to jail. Does this particular reversal of laws regarding my favorite recreational drugs make any sense? Friends have been arrested and charged with growing marijuana, invaded by squads of drug busters who claim to act on telephone tips that marijuana was growing in their homes or their outdoor hemp farms, spotted by helicopters. Why shouldn't they also attack grape vineyards and arrest the vintners of wine? I love wine. I believe the wheel is overrated. Discovery of the fermentation of grapes is among the greatest of human achievements. So also is the cultivation of cannabis in its infinite varieties. The wheel might have sent humanity off on its course of exploring the mechanical universe. Acidulation of grapes and harvests of cannabis have been indispensable to the exploration of intellectual and spiritual cosmos. In vino veritas, in cannabis vertigo. Next only to sex, sipping a glass of red wine and puffing on a joint are ambrosia. Yet these two superb human pleasures and expanders of intellect, and often of love, are falsely wrenched apart. The wine is stamped with public approval and cognoscenti appeal. Marijuana is stained with depravity, and its users are portrayed as irresponsible lawbreakers, condemned to become addicted to heavyweight narcotics. Perhaps it is time for those who like a little smoke of euphoria or the taste of galactic brownies to speak out against these distortions of truth and the spurious injustice of laws that punish pleasure. Our ancestors, who were not allowed many pleasures either, had to wrest liberty from kings and tyrants and from powerful institutions that grew up in their place. If we do not want these hard-won liberties to go up in smoke, we had better wake up, quell our trembling, and refuse to be denied our pleasures and privacies, or we will have neither. The war on drugs, so blithely heralded, is nothing more than a cynical assault on our civil liberties by a government that would increase its power by dissolving the bonds that hold us together. Public hysteria is whipped up against a few euphoric chemicals that, like food or sex, are dangerous only when gluttony overcomes moderation. The society is infected with fear, in particular its vulnerability to crime, which is associated with drug use, instead of social conditions, which produce both the obsessive consumption of drugs and the lucrative market for them. The smarmy pieties of political ayatollahs decry the use of drugs, while in classic hand-tongue duplicity, pocket payoffs to keep the trade profitable through legal oppression. The big money is the real addiction. It has made bribe junkies out of the nation's lawmakers and many of its enforcers. Spacing out once in a while is not what is enervating our decaying society. Corruption, the crazy compulsive pursuit of cash and power, regardless of source and heedless of the price tag, are the historical indicators of societal decline. The pursuit of wealth by any means, fair or foul, which leaves even greater numbers of people impoverished and wrecks the productivity of a society, is the true sign of decay and decline. It is usually then, when everything starts falling apart, that large masses search for opiates to escape their crumbling lives. Overuse of anything is dangerous. Coffee, hamburgers, butter, and sugar are known killers. Alcohol not only addicts millions, it is a direct cause of the automobile fatalities of hundreds of thousands more. Alcohol also is responsible for violent behavior, even my beloved wine, that results in countless beatings and deaths of wives, children, friends, and strangers. Cigarettes kill more slowly, more certainly, but I have yet to hear a tobacco company acknowledge responsibility for the lingering, often agonizing deaths of the very people, about 400,000 a year, which is one out of six persons who die annually, who provide its wealth. Moderation is the genius of Shangri-La, moderation in all things pleasurable, philosophical, and political. American culture is instead founded on excess. The United States, aside from its passionate addiction to money and shopping, is also the world's largest consumer of addictive chemical substances. The usual blame is placed upon a malaise of spirit of the seekers of chemically induced nirvana, not the incessant values of rapacity and greed of the society itself. Money, sex, and drugs have been the American corporate dream since the advent of hucksterism. For the dreamweavers to absolve responsibility by placing guilt on the buyers of the mesmerizing visions is pure mendacity. Drug-free America? How absurd. No more pharmaceutical compounds? Prozac banned? Prohibition once more of grape vineyards and hops fields? The arrest and conviction of tobacco farmers and their government lobbyists? You've got to be kidding. This nation consumes more drugs of infinite variety and purpose on a daily basis than the rest of the world combined. Our real problem is not the drugs we ingest, or our reasons for requiring or desiring them, but our capacity for acquiescing to zealots who corrupt the public tolerance with hysterical exaggerations, proclamations, and demands that we deny our pleasures of flesh and flora. We allow people to have power over us who assume we are collectively as stupid and avariciously deceitful as they are. And so far, in regard to the trampling of our civil rights in the drug war, we have not shown them much reason to doubt their misconceptions. We permit these pathological simpletons to intrude their gross appetites for power upon our forms of relaxation and bliss. As a result, we are separated not only by class, sex, and race, but also by our choices of pleasure. We are separated by intimidation and edict. We are compartmentalized, broken into segments of suspicion and fear, like three-person communist cells. Instead of rallying to our friends and neighbors who are assaulted by improper police invasions of their homes and cells, we shun them in fear our own vices might also be investigated if we demonstrate support or solidarity. The war on drugs, in alliance with the war on terrorism, balkanizes us. Thousands of Oregonians are criminals only because they prefer marijuana to the legally sanctioned abuse of alcohol, and as a result, their freedoms and personal lives are in jeopardy simply because they enjoy the celestial hemp more than, or alongside, the intemperance of whiskey or wine. The repressive atmosphere surrounding the right to choose one's own poison, has sent scurrying out of view the very people who could preserve their liberties and freedom from harassment and jail by openly insisting the electoral process, which has more or less failed because they seem too optimistic about public awareness to effectively wrestle the drug lords of alcohol and tobacco, exemplify their point of view. So what shall we do? Sit on our fannies in fear and helplessly watch our friends disappear until at some point, for some reason, we are also victims of an increasingly repressive government? Or shall we finally rise up and tell the ministries of fear and repression to go to hell? And that was Reefer Madness, which I wrote. This has been Michael McCusker on Coast Community Radio.